Welcome back to Exploring Jewish Thought. Today we're in for a treat. We're going to see the Maharal's take on why we do mitzvot. And what we'll see is that the Maharal, Rabbi Yehuda Lowy from Prague, has a far more complex, multidimensional perspective on the performance of the commandments and what they do. It's very hard to summarize his words or his general take in a sentence or two. By the Rambam, I could have said there are multiple categories, each aimed to impact either yourself, your relationship with God, or the people around you. And by the Ramban, I could have said that the mitzvot exist as character refinement. By the Maharal, I certainly have more trouble putting it into a simple sentence. In general, the Maharal's perspective, his philosophy, is very, very complex, very nuanced, very procedural. If you skip to the end of the chapter, or you just start from the beginning of the chapter, you're going to be missing 99% of the picture, because his conclusion really does not make sense unless you follow his process. So in order to best explain his perspective, while I believe that there's really no proper substitute to seeing everything he says inside, nobody develops his thought better than himself, and especially in the original language written, is going to be most beneficial, most effective, and most clear. I did my best to summarize and translate his general philosophy and break it down into steps that we can take one by one, approach each one, perhaps give proper context or else perspective, other ways of looking at it in order to understand what he's getting at. And hopefully by the end, we'll gain an appreciation for his holistic view on what exactly the mitzvot are doing, what exactly they're doing to us, what exactly their objective is. Now, he starts off by attacking the perspective of the philosophers, and he explains where they went wrong. Then he asserts his perspective, and then he walks you through how he gets there. So let's get started. He starts as follows. It's a common philosophical belief that through the intellect one can achieve spiritual development, and that proper actions are like a ladder or a stepping stool that lead to a more refined intellect. Actions refine intellect. Actions are not influencing us spiritually. They're influencing our mind, refining our thoughts. And then our mind and our consciousness, this is the goal of the mitzvot, and this is how we get closer to God, through conscious thought. The mitzvot, the commandments, serve as a ladder, he writes. And he says, from that ladder, the philosophers have fallen. And we, the students of Moshe Rabbeinu, we stand strong. He continues that the philosophers cannot comprehend. He says, this is where they went wrong. This is why they say what they say. This is why they are incorrect. They cannot comprehend how completely physical actions affect the intangible soul. How is it that actions done with our hands, things that are tangible, visible, and physical, have some sort of profound impact on our spiritual state? It doesn't make sense. Actions are external. Our spirituality, our relationship to God, they are internal, intangible, completely non-physical. Our interaction with the physical world cannot affect spiritual development. Only through our intellect can we connect to God. It is what makes us holy, or what makes us godly in a sense. It is intangible as well, and yet we have control over it. And through the means of our intellect, we relate to God. But our actions do not truly impact our spiritual state. They are so separate, so far, so disassociated one from the other that they cannot have that impact. Now, the Maharal responds as follows. He says, clearly, our actions can influence our spiritual state. Clearly, our actions impact our spirituality. He brings the example of tefillah. Prayer is a spiritual experience. Having mercy on God's creations positively impacts your spiritual state. And in contradistinction, clearly cursing God or murder or illicit sexual relationships, these are spiritually detrimental actions. They negatively impact our spiritual position. They very clearly and obviously impact us negatively. Dishonesty, bribery, worshiping idols, these are clearly bad actions. It's very hard to make the argument that you could murder someone without that influencing your spiritual state, your spirituality, your relationship to God. If there's anything that would damage or diminish your spiritual existence, it would be just that, taking another life, extinguishing the divine presence that's seen in God, and seen by God in every creation. It's clear to us that these actions do impact our spiritual state. It's clear. Although they're external, although they're physical, somehow they influence our spiritual state. He writes that they're all operating forces on the soul. What are they doing? They are refining and they're purifying the soul from physicality. We need to return to the soul to its natural state, that of spirituality. We need to refine it and attach it to God. This is his thesis, or the best summary of his general, I wouldn't say the best, that's a little bit arrogant. This is my best summary of his general philosophy of what mitzvot do. But if we stop there, I think we'd be disappointed, because he makes quite a few assumptions. He goes on what most people think, perhaps, or connect to. He doesn't explain himself. You can take what he says at face value, or whatever you understood from what he said at face value, and that can impact your life and how you perform mitzvot and how you connect to God, and it could not. But if you leave it there, you have no idea how he got to such an abstract conclusion as to what the mitzvot do to us. So then he walks you through his process. He shows you step by step, how did I get here? And the first thing we must understand, the first thing we must internalize or recognize in order to understand how any of this works or makes sense, is the following premise. It's clear that the soul, which came from God, must be returned to God eventually. And if you don't believe in this, then you cannot wrap your mind around what mitzvot are supposed to be doing. We must return the soul which came from God to God eventually. And if you accept that premise, then you can start to understand what our responsibilities are in this world as to what we must do to influence or to anticipate the returning of our soul to God. Writes the Maharal, this can only happen through the purification of the soul from the physical. In essence, stripping away all foreign or ungodly blemishes of the soul that came into the physical realm from a purely spiritual state. Our soul was taken from an entirely spiritual and pure existence. It was taken, put into the physical realm, and it was influenced by the physical. It was influenced by things that are foreign and external to it. Things that don't coexist with the holy, spiritual, and divine state that the soul was taken from. So it's been influenced, it's been warped, it's been transformed by physical influences that are foreign to the very nature of its existence. Then he asks, So how do we return this aspect of God, which has been mutated by the ungodly nature of its physical host, to its holy spiritual origins? Granted, the soul is spiritual. It came from a spiritual place, one of divinity, one of perfection, one without physical constraints or blemishes. It was taken from there. It was put in a physical host with physical desires, with desires to do things that are ungodly, with thoughts and actions foreign to that of its origins. And that influenced it. It warped it. It transformed it. It is now dissimilar to the state that it once was in. How do we change that? How do we create a reality wherein our soul can be refined, refined of the blemishes, and returned to its spiritual origins, to its divinity, to its perfection, to its purity? How do we do that? The Maharal says, that's what mitzvot are. This is the ikar. This is the focal point of his perspective. That is what the commandments do. They're a series of actions that God arranged. God designed them with God's complete and divine intelligence. He designed the mitzvot in a way that would purify the soul and bring it closer to God and allow it to cleave to its host. Okay, well, how did he do that? What about the mitzvot are supposed to be doing that? Says the Maharal as follows. The way that the mitzvot accomplish this outcome is by affecting similarity and association with God. Through mitzvot, we associate with God and make ourselves similar to Him. Okay, how do we do that? What about mitzvot make us similar to Him? And this is really the kicker. He says, because mitzvot are practical manifestations of God's ways. That is the Maharal's position. We must make the soul similar to its source, God. The way we do that is through mitzvot. Why does that make sense? Because the mitzvot are the practical, the physical, the real manifestations of God's divine values. What that means is as follows. God interacts with his world. He interacts with the world through generosity when needed, through justice when needed, and through righteousness when needed. All different aspects of God, different qualities, characteristics, or traits of God. And yet he embodies them all, and through either a balance of his traits or the utilization of one trait when it's the most needed, he interacts with his universe. He gives us mercy when it's needed or when it's warranted, but more often when it's just absolutely needed. We see this by the Jews in Egypt. He has mercy on us. We weren't following him. We neglected him over 210 years. According to the Ramban, although this is a bit of a side point, according to the Ramban, we were never supposed to be taken out of Egypt because we lost that privilege, but God had mercy. God had the initial thought to create the world as a world of justice and strict law, but he appreciated it could just never continue to exist because people could not stand. We couldn't stand in front of the justice that we deserved. We're imperfect. And so God uses justice when necessary and mercy when necessary. He also uses generosity, kindness, righteousness. These are aspects of God. The mitzvot are objective, practical manifestations of those values in our real life, in real scenarios. But it's also a balance. It's a system that works together. The mitzvot tell us, based on the situation, when we are supposed to act justly or righteously or mercifully or sympathetically, They give us instruction for how to interact with every aspect of the world in the way that God would had he been in our position based on his qualities. You know, lehavdil, and so in great distinction to that idea, but perhaps it'll help us wrap our mind around this concept. If you can imagine, you're at a dinner party, and you're cutting people in line, and you're yelling, you're taking food with your hands, and someone tells you, you're behaving like an animal. And you think to yourself in a puzzled way, well, that doesn't make any sense. I can't be acting like an animal. Well, first of all, I'm talking. And even when I'm yelling at people, I'm speaking. Animals cannot speak. I'm standing on two legs. Animals cannot stand on two legs. I'm taking food with my hands by use of my opposable thumbs, which animals do not have. So I completely reject your comparison, sir. I am, in fact, not behaving like an animal in the slightest. But of course, what he meant is not that what you are doing, you would commonly see an animal doing in all of its, in every detail of your behavior, rather that your behavior exhibits certain aspects of impulsivity or else other animalistic qualities. Not to say you would ever see an animal at a dinner party doing the same, but your behavior in this scenario is reminiscent of an animal's behavior in those relevant to the animal. That's what it means when you're behaving like an animal. Not that animals do what you are doing, simply you're behaving in a manner reminiscent to how an animal may theoretically act in your situation. I think similarly, we behave like God if we ask ourselves, or not really ask ourselves, but look to the law and to the commandments. Well, if God, with his infinite wisdom and with his various attributes, were in this scenario, how would he act? What would he do? How do God's values manifest themselves in actions? And if you perform those actions, then you are behaving in a godly manner. In this way, says the Maharal, we behave like God, since we are acting out the practical manifestations of his qualities and his methods. Okay, but what does that do to us? Meaning, maybe that's external, maybe it's simply our behavior. This association with God is what it means to cleave to him. It's written in the Gemara in Sota, Tractate Sota, 14b, after Hashem your God, walk. Now, is it really possible to walk after God, attach ourselves to a divine spirit? What does that look like? How exactly do we do that? I can't walk after God. I don't see him walking before me. Rather, says the Gemara, follow his qualities, because behaving as God theoretically would, to whatever extent possible, that's what it would mean to walk in his ways. Attach ourselves to the divine spirit by following in his ways, acting as he would act. And walking in his ways, that's cleaving to him. Well, how do we get there? Why is walking in God's ways attaching ourselves to God? Says the Maharal, that commonality drives connection. As you find in like phenomena, they are connected to one another. Similar phenomena share bonds, connectivity, similarity, common ground. They can work together. They are not necessarily physically connected in the sense that they are literally attached, but they share a connection through their commonality. They share a bond through what makes them similar. Twins or even siblings, family members, are connected to one another. Not to say that they are physically attached at the hip, but they have so much in common, whether biologically or else through shared experience, similar upbringing, similar education, that there is some profound connection that exists between siblings, twins in particular. They have so much in common. They're connected with one another. Not to say that they're attached at the hip or physically attached in any way, but connection does not always imply a physical connection. There can be metaphysical connections. There can be metaphoric connections. Connections that exist based on similarity. And the more similar you are, the more powerfully connected you are. Through making ourselves more similar to God, we connect to Him. We cleave to Him. We attach ourselves to God. And in contrast, dissimilar or opposing phenomena cannot be found in one entity functioning together. They don't complement each other. Things that are antithetical one to the other don't work together. They don't function as a similar entity. They cannot share that bond or that connection. They are dissimilar. They are detached, distant from one another, completely disassociated. It's therefore clear, explains the Maharal, that theft, murder, illicit relationships, these bring about punishment. Why? Not necessarily because you did something wrong and God wills to punish you, but it's a byproduct of your behavior. These actions that you do are distant from God because He embodies straightness and justice. God, or if God, is the epitome of justice, and you behave in a manner that is unjust, you make yourself dissimilar to God and therefore create distance. Your bond is weakened. You create a distance that is imposed by behaving in a nature that is conflicting with the nature of God. You cannot coexist or bond naturally when you are that dissimilar to Him. Similarly, illicit relationships, they're physical acts completely devoid of sanctity. There are certain relationships which are sanctified, have a holy goal, a holy intent, a commanded intent, a divine intent or goal or objective. The relationships that do not fit that structure are entirely physical and completely devoid of sanctity. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu, God, is not physical. He is not a physical being, and He is entirely sanctity. He is the complete opposite of these actions that you're perpetrating. Complete separation and disassociation with God are byproducts of embracing what is contradictory and antithetical to God and to His nature. The commandments, the mitzvot, in spite of them being physical, are spiritually formative. Wherein if we behave in a manner representative of God's qualities, our souls are shaped to be coexistent with their source. And if we behave in a manner that is contradictory and antithetical to God and to His traits and to His qualities and to His values, our soul is so warped by our foreign influence upon it that it has no current association nor possibility for coexistence with God. The harshest punishment, the worst of the punishments that the Torah prescribes is karet, eternal isolation of your soul. How does that happen? What produces this isolation? I think this isolation can be understood not as a punishment, not as a decision, a determination that you're not worthy, rather simply as a byproduct of your own behavior. Think of our soul as a puzzle piece that is going to be returned to the puzzle at some point. Now, if the puzzle is six-sided, the piece that's missing is six-sided, one a bump, one an indent, one a curve, one a squiggly line, one a crescent moon shape, whatever it might be, pointy, flat, you need to fit at the end of the day. And if you don't fit, it's not a punishment. You simply can't coexist in that environment. You had a responsibility to shape yourself in your lifetime to exist harmoniously within the origin of your soul, the God that you're returning it to, the way that that you were supposed to go about shaping it was through the mitzvot. Through practicing the commandments, you are refining yourself to fit the host of your soul where it's returning to. And if you don't fit, it's not a punishment. It's simply an unfortunate reality that came about by your failure to behave in the manner that you were supposed to. Imagine you ask your friend for a ride, say, hey, can I get a ride later? And he says, well, sure, you know, I'm a little bit tight on space, but I would love to give you a ride. Could you squeeze in the back with two other people? And you'd say, sure, I've done it in the past. But since then, you've put on weight and you're trying to get in the car and the door simply won't close. And your friend says, I'm very sorry, but it doesn't seem like I can give you a ride. Not because he wants to punish you. Simply because the very nature of your existence, the objective quality of your existence, is not fitting of the environment that you would like to be a part of. That's what karet is. Karet is not a punishment, it's a byproduct. You need to exist harmoniously with God. And if you don't, because you failed to shape yourself in his image, behave like he would behave, become godly, then you're not being punished. You simply lack what is necessary for existing in a godly environment. Your existence is non-complementary. It's painful. And if you warp yourself so far in this world by doing the things that beckon the punishment or the byproduct known as karet, what that means is no longer can you exist in that reality just less comfortably. You simply don't fit. It's like those children's games where you have to put the star blocks into the star holes, and then the circle ones in the circle and the moon in the moon. It doesn't fit. You can't put the block in the star. I've tried numerous times. It doesn't go. You're the same way. If you're supposed to be a star and you show up to the next world as a block, you simply won't fit. Fair or not fair, you have a responsibility. You must fit. Now, as a frame of reference, this is not a perfect comparison, but it does help me conceptualize the idea of how we can arrive at attachment to God and cleaving or bonding to God simply by refining our character and behaving in a manner similar to God. So this isn't a perfect comparison, but it helps me give a little bit of context from knowledge that is external to the specific topic we're discussing. And that's the idea of covalent bonds. Now, I'm not an expert in Jewish philosophy or general philosophy. I don't claim to be an expert. And I am even less so an expert in science and covalent bonding and how exactly that works. Very, very far from an expert. But I'll give over the extent of my understanding of the phenomena. Essentially, what happens is a covalent bond is when you have two atoms that are bonding by sharing an electron pair. Covalency can occur, though, in atoms of completely different elements. They don't have to be the same element in order for them to bond, in order for them to share an electron pair. So what do they need? Or the bond is not forged by similar amounts of protons, rather by similar electronegativities. And that's interesting. By two completely different elements, atoms of completely different elements with different proton numbers, They can still bond and share electrons. They need one thing in common, though, and that's their electronegativity. And the more closely aligned the electronegativities are, the stronger the covalence is, or the more true the covalent bond is. If it's absolutely covalent, what that means is that it has an identical electronegativity. So perhaps we can see it in the way that atoms of different elements can bond through their comparable electronegativity, even though they lack similarity in the very elements that make them up. So we can bond our souls with God through our comparable characteristics. We are dissimilar. We are not the exact same, but if we make ourselves similar through having similar characteristics, traits, qualities, behaving in a similar manner, perhaps that makes us similar enough to connect to something divine, to connect to something dissimilar to us. We can bond over our compatibility as opposed to our difference. Now, the Maharal still has to address or explain his perspective on mitzvot we don't understand. If you recall, in the last podcast, we discussed that the issue he took with the Ramban is that the theory worked as long as you could understand why the mitzvah was a clear refining of our character, a clear benefit, a clear influence on us becoming better people through its performance, but that could not explain every mitzvah. It can't explain shatnez. It can't explain why we can't wear wool and linen together. But the Maharal explains regarding the mitzvot, whose reasons we don't know or can't comprehend or are simply unaware of. He says, well, we may not understand how this shapes the soul, but that obviously does not mean it doesn't create an impact. Now, if you're the Ramban, so not understanding how this has anything to do with being a better person is a difficult argument to get past, because if this is not making me a better person in any logical or noticeable or effective way, then it's not performing what the Ramban assumes it to perform. But as far as our spiritual similarity or association with God, I can entertain the possibility that I am affecting that without being entirely aware of how. I can perhaps believe that just as there are parts of God that I, or most of God that I simply don't comprehend, then my performance of a mitzvah that I don't comprehend is going to shape me in a way that I don't comprehend. But just like I don't understand how God is that way, and I don't understand how this mitzvah is making me that way, it's still similar. I just don't understand either one of them. But it's still similar. I don't understand why I need to do this, but in some way, it is reminiscent of God, his character traits, his qualities, his values. And when I act in that way, I become similar to God. And you don't need to understand how you're similar to God in order to be similar to God. And for the most part, you're not going to understand. God's existence is entirely beyond our understanding. That doesn't mean that if we don't follow his instructions, that doesn't make us similar to him. Now, we obviously could not produce the mitzvot. If the mitzvot were a production of human intelligence, then clearly it could not bring about some sort of modification to our soul that would make us similar to God. You would need to understand God in order to produce a mitzvah that embodied his values and made him similar to you. But we weren't expected to produce the mitzvot. And even the mitzvot that we do produce, as the Maharal explains in the first chapter of his Be'er HaGola, which I don't want to get into now, they're all taken from a model of the Torah mitzvot, of the divine commandments. So we don't need to understand in what way these commandments are making us similar to God, because God told us to do them. He told us to do them because this is representative of some quality, some characteristic that he has that we don't get, that we don't comprehend, and we may never fully understand. But that doesn't mean it doesn't have the impact. If we perform them and attach ourselves to them, we're still the beneficiaries of the divine impact. Now, that's not a crazy concept. I think it's actually very understandable. Think about, for example, health. What it means to live a healthy lifestyle. What you eat, what you do not eat, the vegetables, the fruits, the proteins, as opposed to the carbs, the sugars, and the fats. Think about exercise. Think about burning calories, taking in calories. In general, what a healthy lifestyle entails. Now, what's going on in our bodies when we eat something healthy, right? The positive, productive use that our bodies have with these foods, as opposed to the negative uses that it has with unhealthy foods, these impact our bodies because we were designed to break down what we put in us and use it, either to create energy, and if energy isn't used, it's stored as fat, or else to break down its vitamins and its nutrients and use them to keep our body functioning in a healthy manner. That's how our body was designed. It was made to digest food and to use it for whatever use it is most fit for. That's how we were designed. And because that's how we were designed, and because that's what food does to us, you don't need to understand the different effects that a carrot, as opposed to candy, has on your body. You don't need to understand how you digest it for one of them to be healthy and one of them to not be healthy. You cannot claim, well, because I didn't know that cake was unhealthy, it should not have increased my body fat content. Because I didn't know that carrots were healthy, I shouldn't be less healthy because I didn't eat them. I didn't know. It doesn't matter whether you knew. These are objective realities. These are objective aspects of our physical form. Different things we put in our bodies influence us in different ways. Your understanding of their influence does not negate the reality of their effects on your physical form. Similarly, by the mitzvot, you don't need to understand them. It gives us meaning and value and depth when you at least minimally perceive the value of their performance. But as far as the commandments, we don't understand. The classic go-to example I've been using, shatnez, wearing wool and linen together. You don't need to understand that. You don't need to understand why cake is unhealthy, why sugar is negatively impacts the body. You don't need to understand that for it to have the effect that it does. God understands it. God appreciates how it is impacting your spiritual state and impacting your similarity or else dissimilarity to Him. And God is the one telling us to do it. You don't need to understand. It is simply a reality. It is a fact. It is an objective, spiritually influencing factor. One thing we need to contend with, which I'll hopefully get to next week or in the next podcast with the Ramchal, which we'll see is in a similar vein, is then contending with the idea that God would exempt someone who has performed an action improperly or an improper action, be'ones, as in completely against his will, perhaps completely unaware and in a situation where he could not have made himself aware. Because, you know, if someone forces you to eat cake, it's just as unhealthy. So we will contend with that, hopefully in the next podcast. The soul is a divine entity, and the mitzvot are divine actions. Through them, the soul can be divinely purified and refined. All the more so, explains the Maharal, when the soul is engaged in Torah study. How does that make sense? Where does Torah fit into all this? Well, the Maharal is an entire mini sefer on Torah and what it does. So without getting too far into it, we'll just explain as follows. a soul's engagement in Torah, which is direct contact with the divine intelligence, or is direct contact with the divine intelligence. So what does that mean? Well, the mitzvot are actions produced by God's wisdom. But the Torah, that's the very wisdom itself. In its purest observable form in our physical existence. When the soul is attached directly to the divine intelligence of God, it's purged of the natural, of the physical influences. It is direct contact. It is direct interaction with the wisdom of the divine that purifies the soul. The wisdom of the divine produced actions that purify the soul. By going straight to Torah, you're connecting immediately to the host, not reaching the host, not reaching purification through action, but rather connecting directly to the wisdom of the divine. It itself purifies the soul from its physical influences. The Maharal brings as a parable something very, very interesting to consider. And this parable has certainly influenced the way that I see mitzvot, especially the mitzvot that I don't relate to, I don't understand, or perhaps even you may go as far to say as make you uncomfortable. He says, as a parallel, imagine you have two paths. And you're told which one to take, but not because the path is superior, but because it's leading you in the right direction, based on where you would like to go. Imagine, I step outside the building, and I'm in the old city. Someone asks me, as they often do, how do I get from here to the Kotel? How do I get from where we are right now to the Western Wall? And I know that turning right leads you directly to the Kotel, and turning left leads you to the Jaffa Gate. Now, when I tell them you want to turn right, I'm not telling them the path is nicer, it's the scenic route, or else the express route, or else there are a lot of restaurants there, so you may want to eat something. I don't know what they want. All I know is they want to get to the Kotel. I'm not saying the path is better, it's less bumpy, less uphill, more convenient, shorter. I'm not saying anything about the path itself. I'm simply saying, if you want to get to the Kotel, this is where you go. I'm not telling you anything about the quality of the path, whether it's the best path ever made or not. I'm just telling you, if you want to get to the Kotel, this is the path that leads to it, and this is the path that does not lead to it. Now, the Maharal draws a distinction in this parable. He says by the mitzvot, not only are they qualitatively superior, meaning in the parallel, they are not qualitatively superior. It's simply the right way to go. It's simply the correct way. The other way may be easier, but it also doesn't lead to the Kotel. So what have I helped you? He says, not only are the mitzvot superior in quality, but they're simply the right way to go. Meaning if the mitzvot are reminiscent of God's qualities, and our responsibility is to emulate God, be similar to him, then you have one option. It's follow the mitzvot. If you do not follow the mitzvot, no matter what you're doing, you're not emulating God. This is the only path. It's the right path. Not necessarily because it's qualitatively better, although it is, but necessarily because it is the way that God would act, and therefore it is the way that you should act. So, it could be that a mitzvah makes you uncomfortable, or you may have issue with it on a personal or moral level. And whether you're correct or incorrect to have reservations is irrelevant. Because you're most likely missing the point. You're probably evaluating a mitzvah against the backdrop of a very simple, straightforward value. Well, this doesn't sound nice. It doesn't sound considerate of others' feelings. That may actually be the case, by the way. But the question is not whether it's nice or whether it is always considerate of the feelings of other people. The real question is, does God value the underlying principle of this mitzvah more so in this scenario than he values the feelings of whom it may affect? And if he does, and if that's the divine hierarchy, then it's not that we are okay with offending them. It's not that we are okay with doing something not nice or not sensitive. not that we are okay with that. It's simply because there is a hierarchy of important values. Some things, in God's eyes, rate higher and some rate lower. And if you sacrifice a mitzvah in order to spare the feelings of someone else, well, if their feelings are rated higher in the hierarchy, beautiful. You just behaved as God would have. But feelings are not the highest supreme value in the hierarchy. And when you have a mitzvah that is based upon a godly quality that is higher up in the hierarchy than sensitivity, then you must do the mitzvah, not because we don't think you're offending anyone, but because that is how God would act if in that scenario. And that is how you must act in order to act like God. In order for ourselves to be an imitation of God, we have to ask ourselves what God would do in this scenario. And sometimes that may make us uncomfortable. And sometimes we value a different path. But if I were given the option, you know, save someone's life by hurting this person's feelings, I would still admittedly feel bad about hurting the person's feelings. But I wouldn't feel bad about my decision to choose life over feelings. I would be confident in my decision making. I may be uncomfortable with hurting their feelings, and I think it's important to maintain that discomfort. We should never forget that value. We should never forget the value of sensitivity. But in certain situations, there are higher values, saving a life, as well as other values that are represented and embodied by God. The only way to know which value comes first, what is of supreme value, what is higher up in the hierarchy, and by extension, how to act in the way that God would and make ourselves similar to Him, you need to learn the quality of the mitzvot, how they interact with one another, and what comes before the other. Now, in the next podcast, we're going to address the perspective of the Ramchal. It seems relatively similar in nature. I mean, it is far more similar to the Maharal than it is to the Rambam or the Ramban. It's a little bit nuanced. We'll go over it shortly, and we'll conclude our next podcast with my own parable, metaphor, or example that really helps me take all of the abstract concepts that we just mentioned and make them very, very practical and understandable, translatable into action for our everyday lives. I have a certain approach, a way of looking at the commandments and at our mission in this world that is heavily inspired by the Maharal and the Ramchal that make the difficult concepts we just worked through much more practical and understandable in our daily lives. So, Be'ezrat Hashem, the next podcast will address all of that.